Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest, Today's Network Europe is devoted to developments in the Middle East. Hosting this edition, I'm Gabby Katz. We'll be talking to the evacuated and hear about those who chose to stay in Lebanon. All eyes are, of course, looking towards the European Union. Is an international peacekeeping force in sight? That and more discussed in today's Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. European Union foreign ministers scheduled emergency talks for next week. Finland holds the rotating EU presidency and announced the rare August session as world diplomats in crisis mode met in Rome on Wednesday. But we begin today's program with Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros, who takes a look back at the roots of the conflict and forward at its repercussions.
The crisis was triggered by the capture of two Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah militants on the 12th of July. Israel responded by bombing what it said were Hezbollah targets. The Hezbollah replied by attacking northern Israel, particularly Israel's third largest city, Haifa, with Katyusha rockets. The conflict has gradually intensified and there are casualties on both sides, with the Lebanese most affected. So why did Israel find it necessary to launch the military campaign against Lebanon, which it evacuated in 2000 after an almost 20-year occupation? I put that question to Ambassador Eviatar Mano, Israel's envoy to Sweden.
We withdrew with the understanding and the hope that we can live in peace with our neighbors in Lebanon. What happened since then was a series of attacks. The last one was not the first one, by the Hezbollah, all of them unprovoked. We restrained ourselves. But the latest one was really an unprovoked act of war. 8 soldiers killed, 2 kidnapped, a barrage of rockets falling on the north of Israel. This was unacceptable. We had to apply the principle of self-defense.
So the objective of the tremendous force that has been unleashed on Lebanon is to dismantle Hezbollah's capability to threaten Israel. But who is the Hezbollah? Fabia Midman is an analyst of Middle Eastern issues.
The Hezbollah means the party of God, and they were created by the populations of the south of Lebanon who suffered a lot of this occupation. When the Israelis took the unilateral stand to withdraw from Lebanon in the year 2000, it was shown as if it was the rockets of Hezbollah that drove them out.
Though the Hezbollah were regarded as heroes by many Lebanese, they also lost trust among a considerable segment of the population.
Most of all, you have to think that this population has just risen from 15 years of a civil war, and for the last 16 years it has been rebuilding every stone. And now, in a matter of hours and days, all these hopes, all these dreams have been crushed.
Sweden says Israel had the right to defend itself from attacks from across the border, but that the magnitude of its military response has not been in proportion to the military objective. But Israel's ambassador, Eviatar Mano, disagrees.
We are facing here a threat that is directed at our existence as a Jewish state in the Middle East, and against that threat, we have acted proportionately. The solution of this military conflict is not military in itself. It is diplomatic, and it is located in Lebanon.
The Israelis, who pretend they want to weaken Hezbollah and strengthen the Lebanese government, has killed every possibility for this government to stand on its feet.
Those first moments of Beirut's airport being blasted by Israeli fighter bombers were for many on site one more chapter in a long history of conflict. Many Lebanese were determined to stay put, even as tourists swarmed to evacuate. Our reporter Serena Muller was one of them. Serena, you're on the line with us from Italy now. I understand that the trip out of Beirut was long and uncomfortable. You have family in Lebanon. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what that was like for you?
Well, I've got to tell you first, Gabby, to put it in context so listeners understand, I'm a British citizen and a Swedish resident. I'm married to a Swede. So I was registered with both the Brits and the Swedes to get out of Beirut. I've got to say, Gabby, I was really impressed with the Swedes. Now, this could be because, you know, they were really trying hard. After all that bad publicity they got post the tsunami in 2004, the Swedes this time around were super efficient. The Brits, on the other hand, were not. I had to register with them four times before they said to me, yes, we've got your names in the system. They kept losing my mother and my names. And the morning I left, I was going to leave with the British. We were all told to meet at the same place at the same time. We were standing in the baking sun for hours. There were flies everywhere. There was no water. There were no amenities, no toilets. The evacuation leaders on the British side were just screaming at us. People were crying. I can tell you, Gabby, it was a mess. Now, I was really lucky because I called a contact in the Swedish embassy in Damascus and literally dragged my mum away from the British evacuation, where she was guaranteed a place on the ship, to the Swedish evacuation. Now, I know that the Swedes have had bad publicity from the beginning of the evacuation, that some people were spending 16 hours on the boat with no food, and it was really, really uncomfortable. We had that incident when people were waiting for the boat, and a man pulled a gun out of his pocket and said, just to get his family first on the ship. Now, it wasn't like this for us. By the time I evacuated, the Swedes were really well organized. The meeting point was a hotel, air-conditioned, food, water, all the amenities you can imagine. Yes, it was a zoo. Any evacuation, Gabby, is going to be a zoo, but it was a comfortable zoo, let's say.
Serena, please do stay on the line. We'll chat again a little later. Many Polish citizens have had similar stories to Serena's, but as we hear now, not everyone packed their bags.
More Polish citizens have left Lebanon, fearing no imminent end to the conflict. Janusz Danecki, professor of Arabic studies at Warsaw University, is convinced, however, that there are many more Polish people who decided not to leave Lebanon.
They have their own families, children, and they form a part of the Lebanese society, and there's no reason of them going to Poland just to hide away.
Middle East analysts agree that Poland enjoys very good relations both with the Arab world and Israel. In the former case, Poland has close economic ties. Under communism, contacts between Poland and the Arab countries took many shapes, what with the significant involvement of Polish experts in Iraq and a very large number of students from Syria, Libya and other countries in Poland. These links are now paying off. With regard to relations with Israel, the two nations have a long tradition of shared history. But in the opinion of Piotr Kadlczyk, president of the Union of Jewish Communities of Poland, it's not only about the past.
Poles and Jews, Israelis were sharing pretty much the same history. So one state of Israel was founded after the war. Many of those founders of the country were actually of the Polish origin. As a matter of fact, even Israeli Knesset was set up in accordance to the Polish parliament.
There are voices saying that in order to maintain good relations with both sides involved in the conflict, it would be better for Poland to refrain from mediating. But others claim that having a strong position in the Middle East, Warsaw could do a lot for a dialogue in the region. I'm Michał Zając, reporting from Warsaw.
The Polish citizens who did choose to return home boarded government planes. They came back via Syria. German citizens were also evacuated thanks to Poland's mediation. The German government sent military aircraft to Damascus before flying on to Cologne, where the refugees, mostly German Lebanese, were temporarily housed in shelters. Some of them left not only their relatives and belongings behind, but now have to face building an entirely new life in Germany. Kristen Rolf has this report.
Screams of terror as Israeli warplanes attack the Lebanese city of Tyre, destroying a tent.
Every time Aga Rava watches the television news from her Lebanese home, she's thankful that she, her husband, and their four children were able to escape the Israeli bombs.
These are our top stories, and this is CNN Today.
The 36-year-old German Lebanese decided last week to use her German passport as a ticket to safety. Now she is sitting in track pants and a t-shirt on the floor of the refugee shelter in Cologne, while her two sons and two daughters are sleeping next door.
We've got a room now with six beds for us. Everything is so peaceful in Germany. Thank God we've come here.
Agarwa and her family are only 6 of the almost 1,800 German refugees from the conflict area who arrived in Cologne last week. Many of the refugees are German-Lebanese and were on summer holiday visiting their friends and families in Lebanon when the war caught them unexpectedly. The violence evacuees witnessed has left most of them traumatized and exhausted, explains Axel Strang, head of the team of psychologists who took care of the refugees at Cologne Airport.
When they first arrived, most refugees didn't actually realize that they were safe now. Only gradually they understood that they had survived and that now nothing could happen to them anymore.
For Agarwa, the decision to set off for the dangerous journey to Damascus was made when Israeli bombs began striking her home village near Beirut.
The people in Cologne were well prepared for the refugees from Lebanon. When we first arrived, the Red Cross worked so hard to make us feel comfortable and safe. And now they still help us every day.
This help, however, free housing, food, a change of clothes and the most important things for living, may shortly come to an end. In spite of her difficult situation, Agarwa does not want to go back to Lebanon, even after the war. Her fear of bombs, violence and the destruction is stronger than her longing to get back to her sister, parents and her house.
Serena Muller is still on the line with us from Italy. Serena, you had a slightly different experience. Your mother was determined to stay in Beirut. Why is that?
Well, many Lebanese, like my mum, Gabby, have a strong bond to Beirut. And she, like many others, Gabby, are worried that the squatters are just going to move in. Now, people, during times of war, just look for empty houses, look for empty flats. Remember, people are fleeing from southern Beirut. They don't have deep pockets. They don't have money. So they basically sometimes even take a gun and try and move into empty apartments, and there isn't much you can do about it. So my mother is really worried that this is going to happen to her apartment because there's no control, basically. But I do know that some people, some of her friends, are staying put in Beirut because relatively this tension that we're seeing, this kind of violence that we're seeing, is more or less confined to the south. During the Civil War, everyone was a target. You weren't just having the Hezbollah targeted. People's homes were being targeted. One of my mother's friends, she hasn't even fixed the bullet holes in her glass window doors and her chandeliers. That's how close some Beiruti people were to danger. So this, in comparison, is serious, but obviously not as serious.
Just one more question before I let you hang up. Now, you haven't been home in Sweden for several weeks now, and experts here have been talking about a delayed reaction, like going into shock. How are you holding up personally?
Well, I've got to say I'm personally holding up pretty well. Bear in mind that I had quite a smooth evacuation. You know, I'm on holiday, I'm on a beach holiday, but I'm spending most of my time in front of the television watching the latest news because I really feel that I'm part of it, even though I'm not there. A lot of politics is being spoken about. A lot of people are scared. A lot of people in Lebanon have been displaced. And I feel with those people, even though I got out. And I've got to say, when you're evacuating from a country where you're in contact with people who are staying, you can't help but feel a bit guilty.
Serena and thousands of others found that the first stop on their journey to safety was the nearby Mediterranean island of Cyprus. And in fact, tens of thousands of evacuees have streamed in. Our correspondent Tabitha Morgan reports on how this normally sleepy holiday resort has been coping.
First to arrive here were 200 Italian Lebanese, brought to the safety of Larnaca port on board an Italian naval vessel. Sailors gently carried 4 tiny babies down the ship's gangway. The infants' mothers and other passengers followed behind and came ashore amongst cranes and containers on the dockside. Those I spoke to were all relieved to have left the fighting, but anxious about the future and relatives left behind.
The most hectic days of my life and the most disgusting days of my life. I'm in my final days of my pregnancy and I had to leave my country because of the war.
You must feel very relieved to be here.
I'm relieved, yes, but I'm also depressed because I left everything behind, my home, my work, my father, everything behind.
How do you feel about getting here at last?
It's so good because there was a lot of bombs and I was so scared there and I don't know.
Over subsequent days, more boats followed, bringing citizens of France, Sweden, Britain, Greece and Russia. The United States, Canada and Australia all chartered ferries capable of bringing up to 2,000 passengers at a time. At the peak of the exodus, 10,000 people a day were arriving in Cyprus, an island with a population of well under a million. Cypriot Foreign Minister George Lilikas appealed to other EU countries to help.
Other European countries in the region, they should open their frontiers, their ports and airports to offer the same service we offer in Cyprus, because actually we are the only country who offer this service. And unfortunately, we are too small.
Resources in Cyprus have been stretched to the limit. This is the peak of the tourist season, when hotels and airports are at their busiest. Most evacuees have been housed in conference centres and school classrooms. A few lucky ones have managed to find space in some of the island's hotels. Pedros Pierides manages a large seaside hotel in the port city of Limassol.
There has been a very big demand. People are asking for rooms. Embassies are asking for rooms. Associations are asking for rooms. Our own hotel chain, Intercontinental Hotel Groups, are asking us to assist. People left their country. It's a war there. They're coming here not for holidays, but they're coming here for a bed and to get back to a safe place. So yes, we have to be very cautious and very careful and deal with the matter as in a human way as possible.
The aim of the authorities here is to repatriate evacuees and fly them home as quickly as possible. The island's main airport at Larnaca has borne the brunt of this massive exodus, handling hundreds of additional charter flights and tens of thousands of passengers. It's a tiny airport by most European standards and normally struggles to cope with the annual influx of summer tourists. In the middle of the crowded departures hall, the general manager, Curtis Grad, described the challenges he's been facing over recent days.
Taking care of 12,000 people coming through the airport, and some people had to sleep in the airport, so trying to find ways to keep them comfortable. We found some vacant areas of the airport where we found areas to put beds down for them. The Red Cross has been instrumental in setting up some first aid stations and refuge areas and just trying to take care of the people's needs. That's been the biggest challenge.
Thus far, Cyprus has managed to cope just with the influx of evacuees. But with no end in sight to the conflict in Lebanon, Cypriots are questioning whether they'll be able to offer their services in the longer term without more support from their European friends.
This is Network Europe, Europe's leading international broadcasters, keeping you up to date throughout Europe and now broadcasting to wherever you are in the world. Find us online at www.networkeurope.org. Over now to Julian Murasan at Radio Romania International.
There were approximately 1,000 Romanians in Lebanon more than 2 weeks ago when the conflict started. 740 have been flown back to Bucharest via Syria. But the thousands of economic migrants in northern Israel are not easily scared by Hezbollah rocket fire. Menachem Ariav is the mayor of Nazareth Elit, according to whom about 40% of the inhabitants of the town are Romanian speakers.
We are at war, but the population is calm. We've made all the necessary preparations because we don't know if and when we can be hit. We have set up shelters, camps, and we have the necessary supplies. We also have hotlines at the town hall explaining the situation to the people.
The town of Carmiel, also in northern Israel, has been practically founded by Romanian economic immigrants. Up to 6,000 Romanians live in that town, according to Gabriela Roman, who has been living there for 17 years. She says some Romanians from northern Israel have withdrawn to relatives or friends in more central areas of the country. But the majority have stayed. People have got used to the war situation.
Some Katyusha rockets fell yesterday. We can't go to work, but I've been in Israel for 17 years and I've got used to attacks, to the conflict in the territories. You're no longer the European who has not seen war in an entire life.
It is believed that almost 10% of Israel's population is of Romanian origin. The country's economic transition after the fall of the communist regime prompted many to find work in other countries. Most Romanians in Israel work in the construction industry.
Events in the Middle East this week. On Tuesday, four UN observers died when Israeli bombardment flattened their observation post near the border in southern Lebanon. On Thursday, a taped message broadcast by Al Jazeera television saw Al-Qaeda's number two leader warning that Al-Qaeda now saw all the world as a battlefield open in front of us. Meanwhile, diplomatic efforts continue, and French diplomacy is in top gear. Paris has been careful to adopt a balanced approach, sending ministers both to Lebanon and Israel. And this week, the French president outlined a detailed plan for a durable ceasefire. But does the Lebanese community in Paris approve of the French approach?
Every day, civilians in Lebanon are killed for no reason. That was the message of this demonstration against the war, staged two steps away from the Israeli embassy in Paris. Most of the demonstrators were Lebanese people living in France or on holiday in the country. Every night, Muriel and her husband follow the developments of the situation on television with great anxiety.
We just got married. We left on the 3rd, we went to Vienna. We were on a honeymoon, that's why. We just stayed at the hotel watching TV, you know, just to know what's happening. I'm going crazy.
Muriel and her husband did not choose France as their honeymoon destination just because they like the Eiffel Tower and Riviera beaches. They have friends and relatives here. Ties between France and Lebanon go back centuries. The country was a French protectorate from 1920 to 1941. Walid Abdenoul is a Christian Maronite in his late 20s. Like Jacques Chirac, he is against the idea of NATO involvement in his war-torn country.
NATO, I mean, it's run by the Americans and it won't be a neutral force. So I imagine it will be like in Iraq or Afghanistan. There will be bombs every day and there will be like a kind of a civil war again. So I don't know. I think we need more of a neutral presence if there would be any foreign presence. France, it is the country that actually gives a little bit of voice for Lebanon abroad usually.
The term usually applies. For years, France treated Lebanon as an ally, but it was also very careful not to upset Syria. But its relations with Lebanon became a top priority after the transatlantic rift over Iraq in 2003. Bahar Mikail is a Middle East expert at the International and Strategic Relations Institute in Paris.
Jacques Chirac had put a lot of hopes on Bashar al-Assad, the actual president, but we saw that there was much more stagnation, in fact, in Syria. So that's why France considered that it could, in fact, get into bad relations with Syria and change the configuration of the relations it had with Syria if this sacrifice could permit France to get closer to the United States. And that's why France proposed to the United States to adopt the Resolution 1559, which demanded a Syrian withdrawal from Lebanon and the disarmament of Lebanese and non-Lebanese militias or movements present in Lebanon.
Chirac was the only Western head of state to attend Rafik Hariri's funeral after the assassination of the former Lebanese prime minister last year. There is a reticence to send French soldiers to the region, however, especially among French army generals. In 1983, almost 60 French paratroopers who were part of a UN force in Lebanon were killed in a suicide attack attributed to the Hezbollah. Pierre Bouassi represents the Lebanese Forces political party in France. He says the Drakkar tragedy, as it's called, shouldn't lead France to hold back.
I think nowadays about the dramas that hit French militaries in 1983, but this should not stop the French government and the international community from acting to help Lebanon recover its sovereignty and its prosperity.
France is prepared to play a leading role in the international stabilizing force in Lebanon. Whatever the international community decides, Chirac's initiatives and statements have improved his poor approval ratings back home. And in a rare show of cross-party solidarity, socialist and even communist rivals have paid tribute to his action. Paris, Nick Champeau, RFI.
And as all eyes are on the EU in hopes of some kind of peacekeeping solution, Stephen Castle briefs us from Brussels.
As violence continued in the Middle East, the EU's growing role in the region was on show this week, as were the limits of its influence. Crisis negotiations on the fighting in Lebanon were held in a European capital, Rome, and co-chaired by the Italian foreign minister. Even before the event, the EU's foreign policy supremo, Javier Solana, had made it clear that an international intervention force in southern Lebanon would inevitably have a strong European component. But when the meeting convened, it wasn't the EU, but the US that carried the day. The American Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, blocked demands for an immediate ceasefire. The US isn't yet ready to pressure the Israelis to stop their offensive against Hezbollah. In a pattern reminiscent of the Iraq War, France expressed disappointment at the lack of urgency. Britain backed the US position. Behind the scenes, the EU has been working hard to build up its influence in the Middle East. Mr. Solana is a regular visitor and has helped forge a greater European role. Not long ago, the EU tended to be dismissed as an irrelevance by Israeli ministers and diplomats. Last year, they accepted an EU border monitoring mission at the Rafah frontier crossing. The Israeli government has suggested that, if and when an international force is deployed to southern Lebanon, it could be a European one. At the same time, the EU has become the main financial supporter of the Palestinian Authority. It has also sought to cement relations with Arab countries through partnership agreements. Success has been limited. Last year, most Arab leaders stayed away from a summit to mark the 10th anniversary of the EU's Barcelona process. But when it comes to Middle East policy, it's the lack of unity that constitutes Europe's biggest handicap. While the UK tends to stick to the American line, France can be relied on to do the opposite. For historic reasons, Germany emphasizes its special relationship with Israel. While the EU has a growing role in the region, its influence is dwarfed by that of the US. Not only is America the world's only military superpower, unlike the EU, it speaks with one voice.
And on that note, you've been listening to Network Europe. We're out of time, but if you'd like to hear the program again, you can. Or why not browse our program archive, reminisce over World Cup fever, or go royal with a look at the monarchies of Europe. It's all there, networkeurope.org. And you can also subscribe to our podcast. We'll be back next week. Until then, keep in touch with us by emailing contact@networkeurope.org. Network Europe is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine, and Radio Slovenia. On behalf of this pan-European team, I'm Gabby Katz, saying goodbye and thanks for listening.